This episode is brought to you by Adobe XD. Adobe XD is the collaborative platform for experienced designers to design and prototype engaging user experiences. Stay tuned to hear how XD helped me make a product I'd been trying to get greenlit for nearly 4 years possible. Yes, 4 years.
Good designers want to be proven right. Great designers hope to be proven wrong. What that means is good designers just want to kind of get under the radar and get that kind of ego boost. Great designers want to understand what they're doing wrong so they can improve themselves and make it better next time. So that's one of the attitudes that I'm constantly looking for in hiring.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Well, greetings, User Defenders, and welcome to Season 6. I am super excited to be back with you. It's been a long break, but a very nice one. I've enjoyed sharpening the axe, so to speak, and sort of planning some things for this new year. And there's a lot of exciting things happening, beginning with this brand new season. I have been wanting to do a series all about landing a job in UX for quite a while, and I just couldn't be more thrilled to come out the gate with this series. There's going to be 4 parts and many repeat guests. Actually, there's only one person that's never been on the show before, and that's on this episode. That's with Andy Budd. And this one is all about what recruiters want. We're going to talk a lot today about what recruiters look for. I'm so glad Andy is on the other side of the mic for this conversation because he has done some incredible hiring. It's just a wonderful conversation. I'm not going to take up any more time building it up because it's really good. Before we jump into the episode, I just want to remind you quickly that User Defenders Community, aka UD Community, is now live and thriving and nearly 500 defenders strong. Some incredibly generous, inspiring defenders already a part of the community, engaging and helping, and it's an amazing place to be. I want to invite you in to check it out. You can do so at community.userdefenders.com. Hope to see you there. Well, greetings, User Defenders. Jason Ogle here, your host, and I have with me the one and only Andy Budd, all the way from across the pond, right, Andy?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm speaking to you now, sort of live. Although obviously your listeners won't be hearing it live, but I'm speaking to you from Brighton in the UK.
Well, Defenders, Andy, he sent me some bullet points, and I love that he did that because I do read bios, as you know, Defenders. I do read bios before, and sometimes it does feel a little scripted. And Andy was candid enough to point that out, that it can sometimes feel that way. So I'm just going to kind of run through some of these bullet points that Andy sent me, just so you can kind of get a quick snapshot of who he is, if you may not already know. So Andy has been at this for a long time, and so he's one of the OGs of the field. And
nice.
He wrote a book called CSS Mastery, and then he also happened to be a co-founder of Clear Left. And it says here, one of UK's first dedicated UX agencies. So I'd say that is true, but I'd also say one of the premier agencies, period. You've done some really great hiring through the years, and that's kind of what this conversation is going to be about. And I cannot forget, you sent me some really fun facts, and I'm having trouble choosing one because they're all really fascinating. Let's see, I'm going to choose one. So I'm going to read them all because they're all fun. Okay. So here's some fun facts about Andy. He's a retired dive instructor and shark wrangler.
Yep.
He's a trained cave diver. He used to juggle fire for money. Was that like at a Tony Robbins convention?
I used to run a little juggling stand, and I would also busk. So I'd stand in this, there's a famous town in the UK called Windsor, which is where the Queen lives, and there was a big wedding there, you know, royal wedding a couple of weeks ago. And I used to stand in the street, and I used to fire juggle and fire breathe and fire eat. Rich American tourists mostly would give me nice crisp £5 and £10 notes. It was quite a fun and lucrative thing to do. It was much better doing that during my university years than kind of like working in a, you know, in a 9-to-5, you know, job or even a bar. So yeah, that was a lot of fun.
I want to talk about landing a job in UX. This is going to be, this is not just for, again, designers looking for a job. This is for all of us because we never know when we're going to need to land a job again. So I think this is going to be a really interesting conversation. And I've asked Andy to be here today to really talk about what he looks for in hiring designers and, you know, like characteristics, skills, and all those things. So this is just completely off the cuff. I do have a few questions written down here, but this is just, this can go anywhere it needs to. So I guess I want to kind of, maybe we can look at this as sort of like, you know, looking at it as like before the interview, during the interview, after the interview, that kind of thing. Does that sound good, Andy? Kind of going in that sort of structure?
Absolutely. This is your rodeo. So whatever you want to do, I'm here.
Okay, awesome. So let's just say, you know, in the beginning, you have to actually find a place you want to work at. And then, of course, the next logical step is applying. So in applying for a job, what are some ways that designers can get their resume moved up in the pile? Like, what are some things that you've noticed, Andy, you know, in your long career and experience doing this stuff and hiring designers? What are some things that'll help a designer kind of stand out on their resume?
Okay. Well, first off, I'm going to be the annoying guest that actually says, I don't think that's actually the place to start. So, but in a really, really good way. I think there's some statistic that I've seen that says something like 70% of all jobs, I'm making this number up, it's about 70% of all jobs don't even get to the advert phase. So many people are employed before an advert's gone out, before CVs or resumes have been taken in. So much of it is around word of mouth and your network. So, and actually that is so true of my hiring at Clear Left. I would say a good third of the people that we've hired at Clear Left, we've hired because they were already working with us. They were already freelancers and they were amazing freelancers. And us as an agency got to try before we bought, and we had a problem. We had a client that we needed support with. And we knew people from the industry, from the community, from going to events, from going to meetups. And we knew people because they were friends of friends. And so if you are an organization that is wanting to hire the best people almost never hit the job market, because they will say immediately, I'm looking for work. And one of their friends will go, well, look, my friend over here is hiring. So I think the first step is to curate and cultivate a great network of people. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I love going and attending conferences. I love going and speaking at conferences. I like going and organising conferences, because conferences are where really, really smart people gather. And so I think my first advice, like I say, would be to curate your network of people. If you are thinking about moving on, if you are thinking about looking, let your network know. Secondly, like I say, you know, I think being a freelancer and trying before you buy is a great way of doing it. And it also works for the employer and the employee. If you're somebody looking to hire, you get to see what this person is like, you know, in a kind of like a low engagement way. You know, you might just get them on to do a piece of pitch work for a week, or be the second or third person in a design sprint team, you know, or however it is. And you get to see how they work and they tick. And from the other person's view, they get to see how you work as an organization. How will you treat them? Like, are you somebody that kind of like, you know, an interview says, you know, life in this company is going to be amazing, but when you actually get in there, you're treated like a second class citizen. And so that would be my first step, which would be basically beat the system. Try and find yourself a job without even worrying about going through the interview process. Because if you can do that, then you're golden. And this is actually some of the advice that one of my friends, a chap called Blair Enns, gives agency founders. Like, you know, if you get to the point where you're pitching against three or four people, you've got a 1 in 4 chance of winning. If you get in there before the company even knows they need that job done, it's just you and that company, and it's a, you know, you've almost got like 100% chance of winning, because if they know the thing needs to be done and you help them figure that out. So again, from an employee point of view, you know, get in there before the job even gets advertised. If you know, if you are looking for work, you know, one of the easiest ways is just to pick a company that you really like the look of. You know, they might not have a job advert out there, but find somebody senior there. Find a friend that you know that can give you an introduction on LinkedIn. You know, go to an event that you know these people are going to be there and kind of talk to them and suss them out. And you might be lucky and have that conversation. They're going, oh, well, we're thinking about advertising, you know, in 2 weeks' time because we've got this role coming up. But actually, now you said it, well, you know, let's you look amazing. Let's forget about the job interview and just come in and do a little trial with us. So, you know, subvert the recruitment process would be my first tip.
I like that a lot, Andy. I'm so glad you said that. And networking is critical, and especially in the field of design. And it's true that if you're connected with the right people and with the companies that you're interested in, even if you know somebody at a company that you're interested in working at, that's really huge too. And I think about, you talked about conferences. Those are definitely great ways to meet other people and pass business cards around and stuff. Do we still do that? Do we still pass business cards?
I do occasionally. I tend to take more business cards than I'm given. And then I discover those business cards a year later and wonder what the hell was the conversation I was having. So yeah, business cards are a tricky thing, but yeah. The other thing I'd say again is you know, again, before it gets to the recruitment stage, what you want to do, I think, as a prospective candidate, is you need to do two things. I think you need to have a really, really great resume. And that resume could be a printed thing that you send to people, or it could just be like a really, really great, you know, LinkedIn profile. And you need to have a great portfolio. And a great portfolio and a great resume can open a bunch of doors. So, you know, if you see a company that you like the look of, before a job even lands, just email them. Email their head of design or their head of technology or their MD even, and just say, hey, look, I love what you do. People want to be flattered. If you just say, you know, dear insert name here, you know, I've seen so many form emails where it's clear that the person contacting you don't know who you are, don't know what your company does, maybe gets your name wrong or your job title wrong, and that immediately goes in the bin. But if someone contacts you and says, look, Andy, I love what you're doing at Clear Left now. I know you don't have any jobs open at the moment, but if something comes up, please do let me know. Here are my details. And I will go and I will look at their resume. I'll probably go straight to their portfolio, actually. And if I like the look of what I see, I will then forward that to my team and say, look, you know, I know we don't have anything at the moment, but keep an eye on this person. And if something comes up, get in touch with them. Or maybe even, like, just go for a coffee. Go for a coffee, meet this person, sound them out. Because if we're not hiring now, we will be in 3 months' time. And so a big part of your role as running a company and building a team is having a group of people that you are looking out for. Basically, as a hiring person, someone that hires, I feel like I'm a talent scout. I tweeted something earlier today, actually. I'm not wanting to be too self-referential, but basically, I think there are three components to running an amazing company. You build an amazing team that are happy. Happy teams create happy customers. Happy customers deliver business value. And so you need to be constantly on the lookout for the best people possible. And so you're a talent scout. And, you know, quite often we will hire people even if we don't have a role for them now, because they are so good, we know that we can find stuff for them in the future. You know, like a crazy low number of jobs actually go on the market compared to the number of jobs that are done through that way. But in terms of what I was saying, so I think, you know, the portfolio and the resume, which is an important thing to get aligned. So first off, in your portfolio, I want to see amazing examples of design work, obviously. But what I don't want to see is only the finished product. You know, the finished product, the glossy visuals or the glossy prototypes or wireframes, if you're more of a UX and a UI type person, they're lovely. But I don't know whether that was you that did that or a big team that did it or what. Also, I don't know what the context is. What I'm looking for in a portfolio is the ability to tell a story. So I want to understand what the problem was you were solving. I want to understand how many people worked with you on the team, how many people were on the client side. I want to see the journey. I want to see the early dirty mock-ups that you did. I want to see you explain what didn't work and what the client pushed back on and what you did to solve that. I want to see the usability test results. So you're like, well, we really thought this was going to work and it failed spectacularly. But at the last minute, I did this and this and this and we solved this problem. This all comes back to something that my math teacher used to tell me, you know, at school, which is, you know, if you study math, you do a math exam, you get half the points for the right answer, but you get the other half points for showing your workings, because the showing the workings proves that you understand what you did. If all you do is come up with the answer, you might have just done it through blind luck. And I think the same is true even more so with design. You might just be, you know, a gifted mimic. You might be someone that puts beautiful, you know, visual things together, or is just lucky and maybe follows trends. And for me, looking at your portfolio, I don't know. So I want to get into your head. I want you to tell a story that I can go and make sense of how you got to what you got to. And the reality is the actual end result might not look great. But if you can convince me that it was the right thing for that situation on that budget to solve that problem with that client, that is the most important thing to me. And so telling those stories. And I would rather have three or four brilliantly described journeys than dozens and dozens of beautiful looking dribble shots. The other thing I would say is also, you know, again, it's great to have a curated portfolio. I think if you are a UI designer, you know, you can show sketches and you can show, you know, logos and sort of, you know, concept work. I think if you're a classic UX designer in the way that I perceive UX design, which is more conceptual, you know, people that are doing interaction design and strategy, but maybe not doing UI. And this is maybe a slightly more old fashioned view of what UX is. And I think the terminology has changed now. And some of your audience might be going, well, no, I think UX designers do the UI design as well. I don't want to get into that kind of conversation today, although I'd be happy to at another time if you want to jump into what is UX, what is UI, what is product. But people that are not working in a visual medium, people that are doing prototypes, et cetera, it's even more vital that you tell that story. And so take a camera with you or your phone. And when you're doing that, you know, that design games exercise in your workshop, when you're doing that sticky note exercise or prioritization exercise, I need you to take pictures. Because the other thing I do is I look at all the claims you have on your CV or your resume. And you see all of these resumes that have a big long list of like, I can do this, I can do that, and I can do that. Now, you could just be lying. You could have read a book about usability testing, let's say, and you could never have done or facilitated a usability test. And if I see anything on your CV that you cannot evidence in your portfolio that you've done, I will just discount it. Because there's a lot of people out there that are just, you know, frankly lie on their CVs, you know, as I'm sure we've all done, on occasion. So if you say that I can do, you know, user journey maps, I want you to show me a picture of a user journey map. Frankly, I want you to show me two or three, because not all user journey maps are done the same. If you say that I've done, an animated prototype, I want to see an animated prototype. If you can say that you do guerrilla usability testing, I want to see you, you know, running a usability test. If you say that you can facilitate workshops or you've done a design sprint, I want to see that evidence. Because otherwise, it's just hot air. And so for me, the resume is just a list of claims you're making that you need to evidence. The other thing, which is, again, is the dirty secret about resumes, is people do not hire you because of a resume. People use a resume to find an excuse not to hire you. And so weirdly, because you get, let's say you are a hiring manager. Let's say, you know, clear left hiring, and I get 30 resumes from 30 designers. And all of those designers are saying how amazing they are. What I'm doing is I'm looking for bad smells. I'm looking for evidence that the thing that they're doing, maybe they haven't done, or maybe there's something about their resume that doesn't kind of like stand up, And so really, because you're really busy, you get all these resumes through, you know, sadly, you scan them relatively quickly and you're looking for things that, that don't make sense. And so in some regards, you know, a tighter resume, you know, like for instance, like simple things like, you know, you say that you're a stickler for detail, but you spell detail wrong. You know, bang, you know, you're clearly, you know, you're clearly, you know, not doing it. You know, you say that you're kind of like, you know, you stick with company, you know, you're someone that's really passionate about sticking with companies, you know, for a long time, but actually your resume is, you know, you've bounced around, you know, 15 different jobs in the last 2 weeks. You know, you're looking, you know, you're looking to try and find evidence that the behavior they're claiming actually doesn't exist. And so most people use resumes as a filtering mechanism. And what ends up happening is you get 20 or 30 resumes, you ditch 20, you know, if you, let's say you get 30 resumes, you know, you will ditch 20 of them just based on the things that don't kind of add up on the resume. And you're left with 10 people. Then what you do is of those 10 people, you will probably have an initial screening call. And that initial screening call, you know, whoever does it will usually be like a half an hour call just to ask people to walk through their resume and walk through their portfolio to just to kind of make sure that kind of everything stacks up. And you'll probably look at some of the resumes and go, well, that person, you know, has bounced around in kind of like three jobs in the last 3 years. We want to hire people, you know, people that come and work at ClearLeft maybe last, you know, stay here on average for 5 or 6 years. So I kind of want to understand why that person has bounced around so much. And if that person has a really credible, you know, answer, that's great. If that person doesn't have a credible reason for why they bounce around, then again, I might dismiss that as somebody that is not, you know, that. And there's nothing wrong with sort of jumping around and kind of progressing your career. But if you're looking for someone that has staying power, you know, things like, you know, seven jobs in 10 years is not a really good indicator. The other thing I kind of want to see is I want to see some kind of career path. I want to understand why somebody went from one job to another. And I want to see that those jobs getting better. I want to see them kind of growing some way. And every now and again, somebody has a crappy job and they have to leave because they had a horrible boss or it didn't work out for them. So obviously, I'm not going to be crazy critical. But, you know, if I see a bunch of people that have only ever worked at like mediocre agencies, I'm going to wonder why they feel that they should have why they should come and work at ClearLeft. Similarly, if I'm working in a tech company, I'm working at Google, I want to see somebody that has kind of grown from like, you know, a small company to a medium-sized company to a bigger company. Because I know that if you come and work in a Google, you know, and you've just jumped from a 5 or 10 person agency, the skills you will need are going to be vastly different. And that's not just like, that's not an absolute, but that just might be one thing that I'm looking from your resume to tell a story. And if I have a challenge, if something doesn't feel quite right, I want to kind of delve into that. And then obviously once we've gone through that kind of like initial kind of dating process, then, you know, and people have got through the first and second filter, which is the resume pass and then the sort of the phone interview pass, then we'll kind of invite them in to have a conversation. But I've probably jumped into a whole bunch of things there, so I'll stop and take a breather. And if there's anything then you want me to kind of expand on or move in a different direction, let me know.
No, absolutely. That's all so good, Andy. And we're kind of tracking just fine here. My biggest takeaway in all of this, Defenders, is that we don't tend to do this recording and documenting as we go. We tend to try to do all this after the fact. And so my big encouragement for you, y'all listening, is to record your journey over time as it happens. And don't wait until you're out the door to try to remember everything, because it's super hard and it makes your portfolio building process and even resume building process kind of a lot more arduous than it needs to be. Mm. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. On saying that, I think there's two, I don't know if they're caveat, but two other things to kind of consider. I think the first one is, again, even though it's easier, you know, if you're a great designer and you're, you know, you put together the most amazing a portfolio, it can be really, really engaging. But that also takes time. I don't mind if you basically send me, you know, a Dropbox folder with a bunch of assets in it, as long as you can talk me through. So while it's great that that story is crafted, you know, I would rather jump on a phone call with you or have coffee and you open up these boxes, you know, these the Dropbox folders and say, well, actually, you know, this is, you know, this is what we, you know, these are pictures from the usability testing. These are the, you know, the design principles we came up with. Here's an early prototype, you know, so the storytelling can be done in person. So don't worry that you need to spend months crafting the perfect portfolio, because we've hired people just on a really good conversation. And actually, there's something nice around knowing that someone is such a good communicator that they can just tell a story from a bunch of random, you know, bits of paper and twigs and bits of string. Because actually, a lot of what you do, you know, again, like being a designer, it's kind of like being an iceberg. There's a small amount of the stuff that you can see, but actually a lot of the depth is hidden under the water. And a big part of what I'm looking for in design is the ability to tell stories. You know, I love hiring people that are writers, who are bloggers, who are speakers, because a lot of my job as an agency, but also I think in-house, is to bring people along the journey. As an agency, I need to bring my clients along. I need to bring the BA. I need to bring the marketing manager. I need to bring the CEO. The same is true internally. If you're an internal design team, you know, you can't just brute force design solutions. You know, often designers don't have the power and the equity and the seat at the table. So you need to explain to people, you need to sell to them why this is a good idea and why this solves their problem. And so if you are good at selling to them, then you are going to also be good at selling to me in an interview. But also because of that, that goes to my second thing that I was going to sort of mention, which is you need to be pulling this stuff as you go, not just for your own benefit. But if you're trying to sell design to the rest of your organization, you need to be taking pictures yourself. You know, you need to be taking pictures of the whiteboard exercise, because you need to think back and you need to reflect. You need to be collecting all this stuff. All this material is part of the design process. And if you're saying, oh, well, I didn't capture it, that again is a little bit of a warning sign, because it means that you didn't think it was valuable. You didn't think it was necessary, not just to save it for later to show me, but you didn't think it was necessary to use it at the time. And then that makes me start to think, well, maybe you're just cargo culting. Maybe you're creating personas with no actual use, you know, intention of using them. And you've done the thing, and then you sort of throw it away and you move on to the next thing. So design leaves a trail of content and paper behind it in its wake. It's not the purpose, you know, we're not doing design to create these things. We're doing design to ship a live product if you're in the digital product space. But you can't help but create all of this kind of stuff in your wake. And if you're not capturing that, then you're kind of doing something wrong.
Wow, that's so good. I want to veer into education, because we obviously, and I'm totally for education. I feel like, you know, I'm a high school dropout, and I dropped out in, it's funny to say that right after I said I'm for education, but I did drop out in junior year, like the first week. I was just kind of done with it. And that worked out okay for me in my career, because I was driven. I was ambitious enough to learn everything I could and, you know, do the networking thing as we talked about earlier, and finally get my foot in the door. It took a while, the first one. But I want to know, especially now, I mean, this is back in the 90s that I'm talking about, but I want to talk about now, with so much learning available to us online, you know, and how much, I'm kind of biasing the question already, but how important or how critical is education, a college degree, certification, courses, et cetera, to actually landing a really great job in UX?
Okay. Again, a brilliant question. So I have never looked at somebody's formal qualifications and said, okay, I'm going to hire you because of that. And I know very few people who have. But that's not to say that education isn't important. You know, I have met amazing designers, amazing programmers who are self-taught. And in fact, in the early days, and actually even today, a lot of the best people are self-taught, because a lot of the university courses in design, UX, product are pretty poor. And so you know, I look at the work they've done. I look at their portfolio. Now, that would be an easy, you know, you could use that and say, OK, well, Andy says I don't need to go to university. And for some people, that might be true. You know, for some people, you know, building up that huge amount of debt, if they hear that, you know, the certificate is meaningless, then they might choose to kind of go their own path and you know, spend, you know, 10 weeks doing a General Assembly course, or spend, you know, the 3 years that they would have done learning in college to buy all the books and go to all the conferences and teach themselves. But not everybody thinks and works like that. So I think you can get a huge amount of knowledge out of universities, but actually a lot of the benefit is, you know, you've got to work hard. It's not a case of just going to university and then pouring knowledge into you. You go there, you've got 3 years or 4 years. You need to use that time wisely. And some of that might be, you know, building up your portfolio on the side. You know, while you're studying, go and create fake projects, or go and volunteer for your local charity to build them a website, or, you know, have a little kind of like business, you know, modding WordPress sites or Shopify sites in your spare time. But that gives you, you know, what you need to do, whether you are coming out of university or where you're going straight into the industry, is you need to have a portfolio to show. And if you spent 3 years in a university degree, you probably learned a bunch of stuff, but what you will have is 4, 5, or 6 projects. Whereas if you haven't done that, if you're just, you know, ditching university and want to go straight into industry, how do you get that first gig? How do you get the second gig? How do you get the third gig? How do you fill your portfolio up? And so I think there is benefits of going to a great university, but less about the learning, more about the time it gives you, you know, and the safety it gives you to kind of work on projects. But if I'm honest, and this is not an advert for General Assembly, because I think General Assembly is pretty crap, but I think the level of people that I see coming out of doing a 10-week General Assembly course is not a million miles from the level I see of people coming out doing a 3 or 4 years bachelor's degree. And the cost of doing one or the other is huge. Particularly, I think General Assembly and similar courses, because there's all kinds of courses out there, work well if you're transitioning. So maybe you worked in marketing for a few years, or maybe you did a graphic design degree, but now you're switching into UX design. You know, that is quite a good thing. You go and do a 10, 11 week immersive course and you come out with, like, you know, a portfolio full of amazing things. So if you are a self-learner, you can learn without a university degree, but the key thing is building up that portfolio of work.
So I've been trying to get an internal product built for nearly 4 years now, don't ask. And it finally got greenlit recently. The kicker? Due to a large business pivot on the IT side, the dev team has a very limited time window to build out the MVP. Well, thanks to Adobe XD, I already had the blueprints. I was able to quickly design, test, and gather feedback on my prototypes before the business decision was even made. So the next time your stakeholders or engineers like Howard Hughes say, "Show me all the blueprints," you can confidently fire up Adobe XD and say, "Here they are." Don't wait 4 years. Download XD for free and experience design already ahead of its time at userdefenders.com/XD. Yeah, I love that. I think that there's no substitute for experience. And then there's the question of, well, how do I get experience if I can't get hired? Well, then Andy alluded to this, Defenders. You go and you take initiative to go and just knock on doors. I mean, think about a company, maybe a product you use. Go and ask them if you can help. Ask them if you can help with their website, or, you know, just take initiative and make your own projects, make your own way in this. Don't wait to be picked. As Seth Godin says, one of my heroes, Seth Godin says, don't wait to be picked, pick yourself. Mm. And you know, he said something really interesting too. I got to interview him recently, which was pretty awesome for me as a big fanboy. Yeah. I was reading one of his books in research and he talked about like an MBA, which is certainly, it's a great degree to have, but it was amazing. He said, you know what? Anybody who is really hungry can get the same level of education by reading a book for 30 days as then going to college for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And basically have the same level of education on an MBA.
Yeah.
without the piece of paper that says it.
Yep.
So the whole point here, defenders, being, as I always say, use your growth mindset. If you're really hungry to get a job, a great job in this field, there the only thing stopping you is yourself.
I mean, that's great advice. And I'm slightly envious now that you've been chatting to Seth, because he's amazing. I've seen him talk at a bunch of conferences and he's really cool. The one thing I would say, again, you know, full of caveats, UX designers are always going, it depends. I think, you know, one of the great things that you do find going to university is meeting like-minded people. You know, so many of the world's most successful startups, you know, Google, you know, Larry and Sergey, or, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, Facebook, you know, these projects wouldn't have happened if these people had just gone, you know, become a solo bedroom designer. They worked because they found other people, other like-minded people. And so going to university, I think, is often as much around life experience and connections, and particularly the benefit of going to a well-respected sort of maybe even Ivy League. We don't really have that in the UK, but a lot of it is not about what you learn, but it's about the doors it opens. And particularly around the MBA thing, I think you can progress really, really far as a designer without anything like an MBA. But when you start getting into management, when you start becoming a design leader, when you start deciding that actually I want that position on the board, or maybe you want to get into startups and you want to be like the chief design officer, or, you know, a co-founder of a startup, or going to work for a VC firm, having had some business training and business knowledge and experience can be really useful. One of the things I think is fascinating at the moment is there are lots of traditional old-fashioned kind of fusty MBAs, which are just really teaching you, you know, bad economics. And a lot of that stuff you can just get from a book. But there's a whole new generation of MBAs that are design-driven. Places like D School, which basically teaches you a design-driven MBA. It teaches you design thinking. It teaches you how to solve problems in this sort of abstract way, but not just how to solve interface problems, how to solve business problems, how to solve organizational problems. And so if you believe strongly that design isn't just about making something look pretty, but it's about solving a whole wider class of problems, and you have a desire to go and learn at university, maybe don't do a craft type project, you know, a craft degree like graphic design or user experience design, but maybe go and consider one of these new school MBAs. Because again, the other thing that you'll learn at the very least is, if you don't, you know, you'll learn a bunch of stuff there, but also you'll meet a whole bunch of people who 4, 5, 6 years on will be the people running these companies, and they will remember you. And frankly, it's much easier to get a job if you went to college with the owner of the company that's now a multimillionaire and says, oh yeah, I remember Andy from when I went to college with him, I'll give him a job, than, you know, again, accepting a CV from a random stranger. So there is value in that, but there are also multiple other ways of getting there.
That's good advice. So let's dive into the interview process. So let's say that somebody got a call from Clear Left, and their resume, they look good on paper, their portfolio looked good, or maybe they were a referral from somebody there. Those are always the best, as you alluded to earlier. Referrals are great from existing employees for culture. So let's say you invite somebody in to the office or to coffee or something, and you're basically, first impressions are really important, obviously, but I'm curious, does appearance matter? Like attire and what they wear, kind of how they, how much does that matter?
I would like to say, and I would like to believe, that it doesn't matter as much as it actually does. But again, you know, we're moving into kind of interesting but also sort of slightly challenging areas. And so, for instance, like, you know, it used to be a lot of companies would say, well, I hire for cultural fit. And at the time, it was like, oh, yeah, no, that sounds good. We want someone to fit culturally. Actually, that was often a secret way of saying, I want to hire people who look like me and act like me and behave like me. And because I'm a white, straight man, you suddenly surround yourself by other white, straight men. So this is not what I'm saying. But I think there is a value fit, which is really, really important. And, you know, I have biases. I can't help it. If I have somebody come in to the studio and they look like a designer. You know, they've got the right like horn rim glasses and the right, you know, Japanese designer shirt. That will immediately tell, you know, that will immediately give a signal that this person feels like a designer. If somebody comes in and they're wearing like a really kind of, you know, like not very well designed business suit, it strikes me as somebody who maybe is more of a business person, more an accountant or whatever, you know. And if someone comes in and they're just in their hoodie, maybe they're cool, you know, maybe it's like, oh, you know, this is a relaxed culture and they're so confident in themselves that they don't feel they need to dress up. But it also might be that they've kind of misread the signals. So you can't help but kind of judge a book by cover, even if you try your best to kind of avoid being led by those things. I mean, I think the best advice, you know, is to, you know, and this is almost kind of like something Jeff Veen, I'm a huge fan of Jeff Veen, one of the founders of Adaptive Path. Mm-hmm. And he talked about this in terms of public speaking. And he said, go in and just try and be slightly better dressed than the audience. And I think that's true of going for a job interview. You know, you can look at pictures of the agency online or the company online. You can see the Instagram accounts. You can see what people are wearing in the obligatory photos on their, you know, on their website of people standing in front of sticky notes, and just clock that and go slightly smarter. I think if you go crazy smart, people will just think you're kind of, you know, you're not part of the tribe. And if you kind of dress down to the point that people just think you aren't caring. But I think, you know, I think it's important, but I wouldn't worry and lose sleep over it. But then there are kind of like weird behaviors. Like I've been in interviews with people where people have, you know, answered the phone. And OK, you know, it might be an emergency. It might be an emergency at home and you want to give people the benefit of the doubt. You know, we want to be someone that hires company. You know, we want it to be inclusive. You know, if you're a single parent or even if you're not a single parent and your child calls you, you know, that's important. But, you know, I've sat in interviews where the same person has answered the phone three times, knowing that it was from their, you know, from somebody that wasn't, you know, wasn't important, they needed to deal with straight away. So that kind of, you know, a lot of this is about respect and the level of seriousness that people take the interview. Because ultimately, you want to be wanted. You know, you want, as an employer, to be interviewing people that really care about getting the job. And if people are presenting themselves as though they don't give a fuck because, sorry, I don't know if you're allowed to swear on this podcast. I hope I just haven't like
okay.
You know, red labeled you or something. But you want people to kind of care deeply. And if they are showing you disrespect, if they're showing you that they don't care, then why would you care in return? So I think there's a kind of a mutual kind of respect thing going on there. I think the way you present yourself and the way you hold yourself is an element, but actually it's not the biggest element. You know, like if someone comes in and they are wearing, you know, some kind of heavy metal kind of like outfit and they're, you know, they've got shaved hair and they've got piercings and they've got pink hair, but they are amazing designers. You know, you know, we are in the talent business, and actually to some extent, like clients expect you to be a little bit quirky. You know, really at the end of the day, it is such a minor, even though I said all that stuff before, you know, it's such a minor thing, you know. I want creative people. I want people that are good communicators. You know, like, again, I don't know if you've ever met Jesse James Garrett. So Jesse James Garrett is one of the other founders of Adaptive Path. And, you know, Adaptive Path now are owned by a bank. And he is the most unlikely banker you could meet because he has piercings and pink hair and wears dark clothes and has shaved, you know, undercut hair. But he's fucking awesome. And so that's what you're looking for. You're looking for someone that can come in, that has a swagger, that has a confidence, but is not egotistical or brash. You want somebody that can talk eloquently and talk through the story of their CV, talk through the story of their work, that can explain the reasons why they did things. You want people to be a little bit humble. So if you ask someone about, you know, can you do this or that, and they can't, I want them to say, well, no, I've read about this subject and I feel confident I could do it, but I have never actually done it. And actually, you kind of want people to grow. So you also want people to come in and say, well, look, you know, one of the reasons I'm coming to you is not because I am the best out there, but this is me anyway. I want to get better. And the reason I'm picking someone like ClearLeft is because I've worked at other companies. I was the best designer there, but I knew I was not the best I could be. And I needed to go and work with people who were better than me. And the team at ClearLeft are better than me. And so I want to come and I want to learn and I want to, you know, give you value. But that's another thing which I think is really challenging. You've got to get the tempo right. Because I see too many people coming to interviews that are only about what they can get out of the relationship. There has to be quid pro quo. If someone's like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm a fan of the companies and I've read all your books and I've been on all your podcasts and I so want this opportunity. I want to learn from you. I want to, you know, absorb all this stuff. That's flattering. But I also want to know what you can give. And if you don't then move on to that, if you don't explain to me what you can give, how you can add value to the organization, then all you are doing is thinking selfishly. And I want people to come and work for me that will grow by giving, by doing. I want people to bring their whole selves to work. And that means not hiding who they are. You know, we had an amazing talk at Leading Design. So I ran this conference called Leading Design, which is all about design leadership, as you might have gathered. It was in London at the Barbican 2 weeks ago. We're bringing it to New York in June. And it's about 200 design leaders. You might be a lead designer or a head or a director or maybe even a VP of design. A lot of people that come are from really, really, you know, big companies. And one of the conversations, one of the talks from this amazing set of designer, Amelie, and we had a few other designers talking about the same thing, was this kind of idea of code switching. This idea that you come to work, but you pretend to be somebody else than who you are. Maybe you're African-American, but you know, to fit in, you kind of fake a different accent or a different kind of like patois, or maybe you're gay, but you try and hide it because you want to fit in. That's not really good. You don't want to force people to conform. You know, we want, as designers, I want a whole range of different inputs. I want to have people from different backgrounds, different, you know, perspectives. And so I want people to come who aren't just like me, who can feel comfortable enough to be themselves. And so I think it's important to bring your whole self to work, because ultimately, like, you work somewhere, you know, with colleagues 8 hours a day, you know, however many, 300 days a year or whatever, you know, 285 days a year. It would be really sad if you can't be yourself at work. And so, yeah. You know, if you are somebody that kind of likes to go clubbing at night, And you really enjoy that and you have stories, I'm happy for you to have that conversation, as long as it doesn't kind of affect your quality of your work, as long as it doesn't affect the way that you you deliver great work. You know, your gender, your sexuality, your preferences of stimulants, like all of that kind of stuff is your own is your own deal. And, you know, if it makes you a better human being and if you enjoy it, that's great. And it encourages a rich, diverse working environment.
I love the takeaway from this is really be more. And I've said this before, and this is a quote from Sally Hogshead. She says, be more of who you are. Mm. And I think that's the point that Andy just kind of made is be more of who you are. Just bring your whole self to work. You know, whoever you happen to be, just make, you know, and of course, you know, that doesn't mean exchange that for being a kick butt designer, you know, right? Mm. It's both. You bring your personality and be more of who you are, but also kick butt and get your crap done and work as a team, of course. But, you know, there's a quote too that I really like. It's, I'd rather be hated for who I am than loved for who I'm not. Mm. So I think that those are just some really great things, great takeaways there. And I want to talk about skills because we kind of, you know, like, this is something that will come out more in the interview than certainly looking at a portfolio or a resume is, you know, somebody's sitting there in front of you and, you know, and of course you kind of have an idea of their hard skills based on what you've read on the resume and what you've seen in the portfolio. But what about soft skills? You know, what's that tightrope there? Soft skills versus hard skills.
Okay. So I think there are three things I'm kind of burning to talk, and then I know we're all almost at an hour, so we probably want to sort of finish at the end of those three things. But if I can get these three things, that will be wonderful. So one thing I'd like to talk about is quickly hard skills. The next thing I'd like to talk about is soft skills, and then the last thing I'd like to talk about is like design tasks. What often happens with hard skills first is people learn to do a thing, and then they get really good at that thing. And then they really struggle to try other things. So for instance, you know, you might have spent your whole career getting really good at Photoshop. And that's great because for many years, Photoshop was the tool to deliver interfaces in. But then suddenly Sketch comes out and, you know, you are nervous to try this new thing. So you stop and you stop and you stop, and then maybe 3 or 4 years' time, you decide to switch and suddenly you're behind the curve. So I think specialising on tools can be very, very dangerous. So what I'm looking for is I'm looking for tool users. I'm looking for designers that have a toolbox of tools. I'm looking for designers that can use Sketch and can use Photoshop and can use a whole range of other UI tools. If I'm looking for a UI designer, if I'm looking for a UX designer, I want people that know 3 or 4 different techniques for doing research, 3 or 4 different techniques, or maybe 10 or 20 techniques for doing highly effective workshops. I want to know, you know, that they have 6 or 7 different prototyping tools in their toolbox, because it's the whole kind of the whole old fashioned adage that, like, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You know, one of my friends used to say, he said he could look at a website and he could smell which tool created it, because the tools you use leave marks. And so if all you do is use one particular prototyping tool, then there are defaults and there are presets and there are, you know, shapes and things that are already in there. And so these marks appear through the interface. So you can look at different interfaces and go, I bet you it was used on Sketch and it used InVision and it did this and did that and something else. And so what I want is, I want people that are tool flexible, that, you know, if it's a nail, they can pick up a hammer. But if it's a screw, they know how to use a screwdriver. Sure, you can hammer a screw in with a hammer, but it's pretty ugly. And so flexible tool, having a flexible tool set is really important. The thing is that you can teach people how to use new tools. You can't teach people to be nice people. Oh, it's really, really difficult. So there's this Steve Jobs quote. Again, I'm swearing a lot. I don't normally swear, but Steve Jobs used to say, I'd prefer to have a hole than an asshole. I kind of always joke that's because, like,
what the heck does that mean?
Well, basically what it means is I would rather have a gap in my team than have somebody who is amazing, a brilliant person, but who is toxic. You know, I think soft skills are really important. You know, you could have somebody that is a genius, is the most creative person in the world, but if they struggle to work with team members, if they are egotistical and always have to have their way, it's really, really problematic. So hard skills can be taught. Soft skills are often things that have been developed over time. This is the other thing where, like, I was having a discussion with another friend of mine online this morning, which was, you know, he was saying that how he didn't believe that kind of seniority as a designer and your ability as a designer were matched. And I think he's right. You know, there are lots of people who are very, very senior designers but aren't great designers. And there are a number of great designers who have only been doing it for 2 or 3 years. So definitely being senior is not a shortcut for being amazing. But the other thing to remember, the converse of that, is you might be amazing at your craft, but you might have only ever worked on 1 or 2 companies and you haven't got your kind of, like, your world wisdom. You haven't figured out how to navigate tricky political situations. Whereas maybe you're just an average designer, but you've worked at 5 or 6 or 7 companies for 2 or 3 years each, and you understand how to get ideas out. And so a lot of the time I would prefer to have somebody who is a less talented craft designer, but their designs actually get to the market and get to the market in a timely way, rather than a genius designer that is constantly causing stress in the organization and pissing off their colleagues and ultimately not getting their design work out because they're perfectionists. And actually what you really want is you want a blend of both. You want to have, you know, production designers, you want to have designers that ship. But again, you know, I can't remember what I said, but there's a quote I had in a talk recently, which is basically that, you know, it's something like, you know, good designers kind of want to be, well, I've got two. Like, one is good designers want to be proven right. Great designers hope to be proven wrong. And what that means is good designers just want to kind of get under the radar and get that kind of ego boost. Great designers want to understand what they're doing wrong so they can improve themselves and make it better next time. So that's one of the attitudes that I'm constantly looking for in hiring, is people who, rather trying to sell me their idea because it's right or because they don't have any other ideas, because it's the only idea they have, I want them to help problem solve, and I want them to use me to say, well, that doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work. And then to defend some of these answers if they think I'm wrong, but also to kind of accept, oh yeah, no, you're absolutely right, I'm going to go back and I'm going to make changes and improvements. And so, and those soft skills just come with time and are kind of difficult to learn. So I think soft skills are massively important, and they're the things that you can get out of interviews, whereas like hard skills you can just see as a list on a resume. The last thing I wanted to talk about there was this idea of design tasks. And the reason I bring it up is because it's really, really contentious. And I'm not saying that my approach is right. And there are lots of arguments against design tasks. But it's quite common in a lot of companies that would say, OK, we want to bring you in and we want you to prove to us that you're a great designer. So we're going to set you a task or a test. And some of those tests are like, you know, we're going to give you a problem to solve and you come back to us in a week and we'll see how you've solved it. And so first of all, I'm going to look at the benefits of doing a design task. So one of the benefits is maybe you are a really good designer, but maybe you've actually just, you know, worked in the same company for many years. And so you all of your portfolio pieces are the same. Or maybe, you know, you're working in a company whereby, you know, you're somehow you're being limited by the organization. You know, you have an opportunity to do great design. So there are people out there who are great designers that have got terrible portfolios. And there are also people that have got great portfolios because they were working in an amazing company that had an existing design language, that had brilliant designers around them supporting them, versus somebody that was working in an old fashioned company that was doing as good as they could do, but didn't have the support. So it's really difficult to judge the designer, I think, just purely from their portfolio alone. And so the best way, I think, to judge a designer is to work with them to see them design. Because if you work with them to see them design, then it's a level playing field. They're now on their own. They've not got their support mechanism. They've not got their design system. And you can really see them work. And so we love doing, or we have in the past, loved doing design tasks. We have in the past done the task where you go away for a week and you come back and you give us a design. We've sort of stopped doing that. More and more what we're doing is like design tasks which happen during the interview. And maybe it's not a big design task. Maybe it's just like a 2-hour whiteboard exercise. And often it's not even alone. It's something you do with another one of our senior designers. And often that's a way of seeing people and working with them and kind of getting a better understanding of how they tick. So I quite like them. The counter argument design tasks is, first of all, it's a lot of effort for people to go through that's often unpaid. And actually, the really, really good designers have got so many opportunities out there that they'll go, well, I'm not going to be bothered doing a 2-day design task because, you know, I'm being headhunted by all these companies. It's just a hassle. Although you could argue that if the people really, really genuinely loved your brand, they would go through that process. Another argument against design tasks are particularly ones where the company says, hey, I want you to solve a problem that we currently have. You know, we've got a problem with sign up and I'm going to get 10 people to solve the problem. And what ends up happening is you get people to solve the problem for you. And it's basically spec work, which is horrible. So if you're going to set a design task, you need to set a design task that's fake, that has no benefit to you. You know, classic ones are like, you know, oh, designer, you know, I think it might be an IDEO test or whatever, like, you know, design a automated coffee making machine interface. And really, you know, if it's a lower or mid-level designer, you're wanting maybe to look at the craft skills. As a senior designer, you're wanting to ask the questions to make sure that they're kind of speccing it properly and they're understanding the problem. The other challenge, which ultimately is like, you know, if you are young and single and out of work, and someone gives you a design task on a Monday and says, deliver me something by next Monday, you could work 7 days, you know, 12 hours a day, and do an amazing job. If you're giving that same job to somebody who is a parent, who has childcare duties and is working full time, you know, they might only be able to find an afternoon on a Sunday, 6 hours to do the same thing. So even though you might believe that you're setting an even challenge, somebody spent 50 hours on it, somebody spent 5. And so what you need to do if you are doing a design task, you need to make sure that you mitigate for that. And also people have health issues, you know. And so if you are going to do a design task, you need to try and be respectful. And also, I think if people do have concerns around childcare or health issues or just time, that you figure out another way in which you can assess that person that doesn't discriminate against them. But I think if done well and done smartly, design tasks can be a really great tool for hiring managers to judge people and judge their fitness, and actually is a benefit to to people that maybe are great designers but don't have the perfect glossy shiny portfolio.
That's awesome. I've encountered this myself where I've been asked to do design exercise to get in and, you know, to try to get my foot in a door somewhere. And it ended up being basically like, can you redesign our product page? And it's almost like even if it's not the intention of the employer, it almost feels like, especially if you don't get the job, it feels like, wow, I just gave you free ideas. I gave you free work and that you could potentially use. And it just feels unethical to me. It can come across that way, even if it's not intended to. So I'd say be really careful there with that. So that was great advice there, Andy. So after the interview, and you can give me like a one sentence response to these next two. So after the interview, what's a good length of time a designer should follow up if they don't hear from a recruiter?
That's really tough. I mean, to be honest, and actually, this is one of the challenges I see quite often. And I really feel sorry for a lot of people who are interviewing, because often you're interviewing because maybe you've just lost a job and you want to get employed again really quickly. And so you'll respond to dozens of interviews and often, you know, dozens of job ads, and often people won't even respond back to say they've seen the CV. So I think it can be really tough. I think as an interviewee, as a company, you need to try and respond as quickly as possible. And you need to, you know, you need to understand that people are going through a process and need response. On the other hand, you know, one of the things that Clear Left are is we're very slow to hire. You know, we want to make sure that we've made a right decision, because, you know, again, throwing a bad apple or throwing somebody that isn't going to work out into the company can, you know, push you behind 12, 18 months and kind of make a mess. And so we tend to be quite slow. And so it might be, and also because we might be interviewing a bunch of people, you know, that interview process, you know, from the first person that interviews to the last person that interviews could theoretically be a month. Because the first person in the interview might have been the first person to throw their CV in. But maybe, you know, we've lined up the interview, but then there's a last minute candidate that comes in, but then they're busy or they've got to go on holiday or what have you. So we try and be really good communicators to people who have submitted. But I think a lot of people who are applying for jobs, like we'll put an application in or go to an interview and then almost be really, you know, convince themselves they haven't got the job when they haven't heard back a day or two later. And so I would say, like, hold your course. You know, don't immediately write yourself off. Don't be too critical, because it might be that you're the perfect person, but that somebody is coming a bit late or they're trying to give somebody a break because they've had a hospital appointment or whatever, and they might not be able to get back to you and tell you yes or no for 2 or 3 weeks. On saying that, I don't think it's ever bad to follow up. You know, I think it's perfectly reasonable to follow up immediately afterwards and say, look, I really enjoyed that interview. You asked me some really brilliant questions. There were a few things that, you know, maybe I didn't fully flesh out. You know, here's some links, et cetera, et cetera. No one's going to kind of penalise you for showing keenness. I think if you follow up, you know, 2 or 3 days later, you know, or 4 or 5 days later, just saying, oh, I just, you know, wondered if there was any news. Again, you know, that's not a major problem. If you're doing it every 2 or 3 days, then that starts to get a little bit needy, and neediness is not an attractive trait. You know, sometimes it's a case of being honest. Sometimes it's a case of emailing and saying, look, I really, really liked the interview. I would really love to come and work with you, but, you know, I've gone for a couple of interviews and I've got a couple of job offers. You know, I you're my preferred company, so I can probably hold off these other offers for a week or so, you know, but let me know. And actually, weirdly, you know, if somebody wants you and you put a little bit of pressure on them, they will indicate whether they think you're worth holding on to. If you send that email saying, look, you know, I've got a couple of other offers, but you're my preferred one, and people don't contact you back, then that's probably a good indication that they're not as interested as you might hope they were. So you can use kind of little subtle techniques just to kind of, you know, ramp up the tension. I mean, and I'm not saying lie. Like, if you haven't got any other people you're talking to, don't just blatantly say that to kind of, you know, put the tension down. But sometimes people are busy. The last thing a hiring manager wants is to see the perfect candidate, but miss that candidate because somebody else is going to hire them first. And so, yeah, just be open and honest with your timelines, and good stuff will happen. And frankly, the other thing, lastly, is, you know, I've seen people that you know I have interviewed with that I really liked, but they weren't right now. And so again, the other thing is that if you get a rejection, it's difficult, you know. But I think one of the great things about design is we're used to critique. And so an important thing to learn as a designer often is when I'm saying that something is not working about your design, I'm not critiquing you as an individual, I'm critiquing your design. And often the same is true of an interview. I am not judging you as a human being. I am judging you as a set of capabilities for this particular role. And just because I think you are not right for this particular role does not mean that I do not think you might be right for future roles. You might be a little bit too broad or a little bit too specialist or a bit too junior or a bit too senior for this particular role. I've seen a lot of designers come to me who think they are mid to senior, but they're actually junior. But when that role comes up, you know, we will get back to them. So again, just because you've been rejected for this one role, you know, be gracious. And at the end of it, just like say to them, well, look, you know, I'm sorry it didn't work out this time. I would love to kind of, you know, to do something with you again. I'd love to get a little bit of a breakdown on what you thought. I want to get some feedback. And actually, if you can do that by phone, that's brilliant. And leave the door open, you know. It's the same with kind of selling design work. You know, if you fail in a pitch, the last thing you want to do is kind of like, you know, be, you know, crappy with the client and say, well, I'm too good for you anyway, and, you know, see you in another life. Yeah. You kind of want to say, well, look, I really enjoyed meeting you. I'm sorry that we weren't, you know, you didn't feel we were the right agency for you now. But if in 6 months' time the supplier that you've picked doesn't work out, would love to get an opportunity to work with you again. And in the meantime, if you've got any advice for me for how we might have solved some of the problems that you didn't see us, you know, delivering, please let me know. And so you do exactly the same thing as a design candidate or development candidate or a product management candidate or whatever. You might find that in 6 months' time, you get a knock at the door that says, hey, look, you know, we've got exactly the right role for you.
Yeah, that's awesome advice, Andy. And you know, you kind of touched on this a little bit, but if it's a pass, and first of all, defenders listening, Andy just mentioned this, but don't burn bridges. Like, you might feel, and I can totally empathize because I've taken it very personally, and you can't help it. It's not just business. It is personal, you know, because you put a lot into it and you're really, and sometimes you are desperate, but you know, you don't want to let off too much on that because it is unattractive. You know, I would just say that, my question being, Andy, if it was a pass, should designers inquire as to why for future learning?
Or
does that seem desperate?
No, totally. I mean, again, that's a very attractive quality. Somebody that wants to improve, coming to someone and say, well, look, you know, I'd love to get your advice on what didn't work. And I have built friendships, and I have built, you know, 3, 4, 5 year relationships with people that are coming to interview that weren't right at the moment, but we had a conversation or we went out for coffee and I explained why, and then they grew, and then I mentored them, and then 2 or 3 years later they were right for that role and we've hired them.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of, again, you know, it's like romantic relationships. You know, there are people who are amazing, you know, for you, but neither of you maybe are in the right place in your lives at the moment. But who knows, 3 or 4 years down the line, you know, you might be perfect for each other. And so there's nothing different, I think, between romantic relationships and business or professional relationships. It's not about you being a bad person necessarily. It's just about the timing or where you are in your career journey, or the company's career journey. But the other thing that I was going to leave you on is this idea. A guy in the UK called Simon Wardley has this kind of concept of pioneers, settlers and town planners. And different sizes of companies need different makeups. So maybe when you're a small little startup, you're full of pioneers, people that are like charting the way and finding new territory. But as you grow to a mid-sized client company, You don't need those pioneers anymore. You need settlers. You need people that can use the lands that you've discovered, and they can till the soil, they can plant the seeds, they can grow and they can prosper. And, you know, and then maybe as you grow even bigger to like a big mega corporation, you need the town planners that can put in the infrastructure and kind of like the roads and the fire service, et cetera, et cetera. And different companies need different sets of skills at different times. And it might be that you went and hired for this company and you were like a settler. You were great at taking things that already exist and making them optimized, making them really, really profitable. But they were looking for a pioneer. Or it might be that you were the pioneer, but, you know, maybe the company was already past that and they're looking for a lot of settlers and town planners. But then they might spin up a new unit and they want a pioneer to kind of help be part of that unit. So again, it's not just about you as an individual, you know, it's not about you failing, you know. You know, you have a unique set of capabilities and skills which are right for different people and different organisations at different times. And that is really, really important to remember.
Ah, so good. Andy, I'm going to let you go because you've been so generous with your time, and I thank you for staying on longer than I said it would be. Thanks for the great advice. This is there's so much value in this conversation. I know the defenders are going to glean from and talk about and apply to their job search both now and in the future. So thanks so much, my friend. Let's definitely do this again another time. And last but not least, I just want to say, as always, fight on, my friend. I think one of my biggest takeaways from my rich time with Andy is this. When you're looking for work, make sure, and when you're interviewing, make sure you communicate how you're going to add value to the company. Because, you know, we're all asking this question all the time, understandably so. What's in it for me? When we put our money into something, what's in it for me? I totally get that. I'm the same way. But we need to also remember that companies are asking the same question when they're interviewing us. What's in it for us? What's in it for this company? And it may sound selfish, but it's really not. Like, this is a value exchange, right? And that's why employment is at will. So I think it's important to not only verbally communicate how in the interview, how you're going to add value to the company, which part of that, again, is through the soft skills, which is another great takeaway from Andy today's conversation, about your hunger, your passion to grow within the company and to learn everything you can within your role. That is also great. But communicate that through your portfolio, which is a conversation coming up with Sarah Duty after this, actually. Communicate how you added value to your projects. That is really important, for sure. And also in how other people talk about you. I think, you know, when you get a LinkedIn review even, like, those are all, and that's on you, that's on us to be that person that adds value every day, showing up, like Seth Godin says, show up every day consistently. And you don't have to try to toot your own horn. Other people will do that and will vouch for you if you live that life that's consistent. So those are just some great takeaways today from Andy Budd, all about what recruiters are really looking for when hiring designers. Tweet your takeaways, defenders. Andy and I would love to engage with you around this episode. I'm at User Defenders and Andy is at Andy Budd. The UD community is live, defenders, and it is thriving. There's nearly 500 strong at the time of recording this, defenders engaging, and not all of them are engaging, but there are certainly a lot of folks in there engaging and connecting and inspiring and serving. So all the things that I was hoping for when launching this are coming true. And so it's really, really a great place to be, to stay encouraged, stay inspired. I highly recommend you join us. Go to community.userdefenders.com and check it out. You can kind of get a nice snapshot of what you'll get, what's in it for you, because as we mentioned, I know that's important. So check it out. Let me know if you have any questions at all. You can reach me on Twitter at User Defenders. I want to thank Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork. He did an amazing job drawing Andy Budd and a nice aquatic theme, because Andy is a shark wrangler, as we learned. I want to thank Adobe XD for sponsoring not only this episode, but this entire season exclusively. And They are my superheroes. They came to save the day and to help keep the lights on and what I'm doing here in this show. And thank you so much, Adobe. And it's a great product. As I say, you know, like the Hair Club for Men president, I'm not only a sponsor, I'm a user, and I love the product. So check it out, userdefenders.com/XD. It is now free. Stay tuned. Our next episode is with repeat super guest Sarah Duty, all about building an effective portfolio. So much great advice and encouragements from Sarah on doing this. And this is a big deal. So that's coming up next time. Thanks so much for listening, Defenders. I am, again, super excited to be back with you. And until next time, as always, fight on, my friends.